My guest today will certainly find it easy to keep me on track. Before I get on the track, I want to make a personal remark that ties in to the subject matter. May of 1976, I'm living with my wife and our first of eight children along the railroad tracks in Glen Ellen, Illinois. Early in the morning, about 25 railroad cars and two or three engines left the track and rolled down towards the apartment we lived in. In fact, one of the engines came to a stop within a foot of the brick wall which separated the front of that engine and my daughter's crib. So that was very exciting. A lot of energy released with all of that commotion. Today's guest will tell us of other staged incidences of railroad disasters. Mr. Jim Reisdorf, please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Patrick. Again, I am Jim Reisdorf from David City, Nebraska. I am a writer and book publisher, a small niche book publisher out here in the boonies of Nebraska. I've been working at my craft for about 40 years now, having published my first book in 1982. And since then, I've both co-authored and otherwise published a number of books on the subject of railroad-related topics. Just wanted to relay that, again, that I've mainly been publishing for other authors rather and do author books myself when the occasion allows me to.
Jim, is it easy for listeners to find your books through South Platte Press?
Yes, it is. Of course, I do have a website to that effect, and otherwise, of course, I distribute my books through dealers around the country, both those who cater specifically to railroad history topics and otherwise through museum gift shops and general interest bookstores.
The story of Head-On Joe Connolly. The story is just so odd and eccentric. I think it deserves being told now and shared with my listeners. Can you tell us a little bit about who Joe Connolly was?
Initially, Joe Connolly was a farm boy from Colon, Iowa, which is in the vicinity of Des Moines. He did, again, for 30-plus years, was to essentially stage train wrecks between two old steam locomotives for both fun and profit. He had gotten the idea of initially doing this while living on the family farm near Colon there, and or Colo, I should say, C-O-L-O. He sit on farm fence and watch the old steam-powered trains go by the farm, and he'd always kind of wonder what it'd be like to see one of them collide with another one. But of course, he grew up to manhood without that little curiosity being unsatisfied. In the course of his career, he got into the entertainment business. I understand he operated some theaters in Des Moines at one time, and kept in the back of his mind this desire to see trains collide and see what would happen as a consequence of that. Well, back in 1896, the Iowa State Fair at Des Moines was looking to have some kind of a new attraction, draw the crowds in, and Joe got the idea that if he went to the fair board and told them that he could provide them a rather unique attraction, that they might be willing to go for it. And turns out they were certainly interested in what he had to offer. And again, that was to go to the grandstand area of the state fairgrounds there and laid track in front of the grandstand and by a couple of old steam locomotives, one of the local railroads, and stage those locomotives at either end of the track. He would then hire a couple of engineers known for being rather of a stout heart and having a bit of nerve, hire them to, of course, power up the locomotives at the designated moment and then have them charge each other on that stretch of track. And then just when they had the speed build up to where they would be able to provide some level of destruction between the two engines, then the engineers would jump off the train and there would consequently, of course, the engines would meet at the designated point of impact and, of course, promptly draw each other to some degree. Thereby, of course, the crowd, which, of course, had paid an admittance fee to see the spectacle, of course, got their money's worth. And Joe, of course, got his money's worth insofar as making a profit off of providing this bit of entertainment to the crowd.
The event must have been so dramatic. I can imagine the two locomotives, like raging bulls facing each other, blowing off black smoke. They were probably coal-fired engines.
Oh, yes. Yes, they would have been coal-fired at the time. And they did, of course, try to make the thing, that spectacle and others that Joe would repeat in the future a little more spectacular by putting a little explosive devices on the track, which would, of course, as the train would run over them, they would set off those explosives, so you'd have this bangety, bangety, bangety effect. And then, of course, the engineers would, as the trains approached each other, they would tie down the whistles of the engines, and so these two engines would be, whistles on the engines would be screaming loudly as they collided. So, again, like I say, Joe, as he perfected his craft, so to speak, at for these staged wrecks, would add these little additional sound effects, I guess, to make them the ultimate thrill a little more for the audience.
As I recall my personal experience with that 1976 train accident, I remember we lived in an apartment, so I remember the folks that lived the next floor up. And when we finally met them in a community center after the accident, they were literally thrown out of their bed by the power of the accident. So I imagine that these people that are going to the fairgrounds are getting a lot of experience from the sound and from the shaking ground.
Well, and of course, you must also recall back in the when Joe started his train wrecking career, railroads, of course, were still very much the premier way of getting around back in those days. And so, of course, railroads, of course, meant everything pretty much meant everything to people insofar as what it meant, what they meant to their personal lives. Railroads were, of course, responsible for both their transportation and, of course, their making their livelihood easier by taking people to their jobs or otherwise. Railroads brought goods and services that people used for their everyday lives, their household goods and their food and their fuel and such. So again, railroads, again, like I say, played a vital part in people's everyday lives back then, or so it was more evident, you know, back then. So, again, like they were certainly entranced at the idea of seeing something that was pretty much every day to them, i.e. a railroad train and the orderly technique in which it delivered goods to them all of a sudden be transformed into something very out of the ordinary and have the orderly technique of the of trains suddenly be thrown into disorder, I guess.
It's easy for me to imagine that a significant amount of the people that would gather at the fairgrounds in Des Moines may never have actually seen a working train. They might live in a remote part of the state where there just wasn't any rail laid.
Well, that might have been true in the earlier days, but by 1896, Iowa, for one state, was very much crisscrossed by railroad tracks. So again, it would have been difficult by then for someone not to have seen a train by then. I think at Iowa was one of the top states to have railroad mileage added to it during the height of railroad expansion in the 19th century. And I think at one time it was stated that there wasn't any point in Iowa where someone was more than 20 miles or so from the nearest railroad tracks. Again, it's just, again, it gives you the idea of how much railroads meant to the progress of a state like Iowa back in the 19th century.
I remember a story, and it involves Jefferson Davis, who later becomes president of the Confederate States, Robert E. Lee, who later becomes primary general of the Confederate States, and Abraham Lincoln. And the story centers on their activity in the area of Davenport, Iowa. Apparently, Robert E. Lee, not long out of West Point, is there in Davenport and cites a location that he thinks is a perfect place for the railroad crossing of the Mississippi River. And later, commercial interests are trying to make the development of that bridge. They have to, though, go through the United States federal government office administered by Jefferson Davis, who was a Southern man. He had no interest in seeing economic development go west, so he never, ever approved the building of the bridge. Well, at some point in time, the bridge is approved, maybe by him, I don't remember. And not long after it's operational, the commercial interests that are threatened by the railroad, an individual takes an old barge, stacks a bunch of hay bales on it, parks it underneath the new bridge, and burns the bridge down while the barge is set aflame. And eventually, the case goes to an appellate court in Chicago, and the railroad company is hiring an attorney by the name of Abraham Lincoln, and he prevails. But I think it's so interesting there in Davenport, Iowa, those three individuals who later become such adversaries. So the story of the railroads in Iowa is, I think, replete with fascinating
facts. Yes, indeed.
When did the railroad cross the Missouri River into Nebraska?
Well, into Nebraska, the actual first crossing of the Missouri River into the western regions occurred down in the St. Joseph, Missouri area. In Nebraska, the first bridge across the Missouri River between Council Bluffs and Omaha was completed in 1872. So story goes that, of course, the first transcontinental road, you know, is normally thought to have been completed in 1869 when the Union Pacific building west, of course, and the Central Pacific building east from Sacramento, California, met at Promontory, Utah. But, of course, it can be technically argued that the first transcontinental railroad wasn't completed at that time in 1869 because, of course, the bridge across the Missouri River wasn't completed until 1872. But, of course, a railroad line called the Kansas Pacific had completed its line across the Missouri at St. Joe there by then, of course, and it had already built the line, its line across Kansas, and ultimately reached Denver and then on up to Cheyenne. So it's technically been argued that was the first actual transcontinental railroad that was completed, because, of course, that was a complete railroad journey rather than one that was required people to come by train as far as Council Bluffs and take a ferry across the river and then get on a train again in Omaha. So again, like I say, it's been technically argued that the first transcontinental railroad was completed by the Kansas Pacific rather than the Union.
That's interesting. I read once that when the Union Pacific was complete, at that time, 8,000 cities and towns.
Well, again, of course, what normally took a trip by horse and wagon 6 months or more, of course, now could be completed in, transcontinental railroad trip could now be completed in 6 days. So, again, you can just imagine the staggering leap in technology that took place at that time, insofar as transportation was concerned, both for people and for goods across the country.
Sure. I want to get back to Joe Connolly. He managed shows other than...
Yes. Once he found out that the technique could be done both safely and at a profit, he started to offer to do this train wrecking technique at other shows around the country, both at state fairs and whatever other large public gatherings being done at that time. So it's been reported again that he staged at least 40 of these or thereabouts train wrecks during the course of a 30-year career, and he supposedly reduced about 142 steam locomotives to scrap. And again, these were locomotives that the railroads were planning to scrap anyway. And so, of course, he was able to buy these locomotives from railroad companies at a low price and then, of course, turn around and charge a good-sized admission fee to have people come in and witness these events and get their curiosity satisfied at seeing something destroyed.
Besides Joe Connolly, were there other promoters of this kind of entertainment?
Oh, yes. Again, what it was is that some people think that Joe originated this idea of wrecking trains for fun and profit, but that wasn't the case. Probably the first such incident that is very well known happened at Crush, Texas, back in about 1896. What it was there was that a promotions man for the Katy Railroad determined that people might be interested in, again, seeing this technique perfected for entertainment. So what they did was they took a location outside of Waco, Texas, and again laid about a mile of track there for the two trains to build up speed upon. And of course, they heavily promoted the event to take place on a certain day. And of course, they to benefit the railroad offered to operate special trains from across Texas to this location called Crush, Texas. And happened to have some promoters also sell lemonade and whatever souvenirs and whatever they could at that site as the big build-up to the event. Anyway, on the day in question, they did have Mr. Crush, who happened to be the name of the fellow doing the promotion as well. He acted as the promoter, trying to say the ringmaster of this particular event. He oversaw the safe promotion of this event, which again drew thousands of people to Crush, and at the appointed time, he, of course, gave the signal, and the two trains charged each other, and again, to the delight of the crowd, they did collide rather spectacularly. However, unbeknownst to the experts who said that it probably would never happen, or that it couldn't happen, the boilers of the two locomotives then exploded, and of course, scrap iron from the explosion flew up in the air, and then of course just rained down upon the crowd, and sadly, three people were killed by the debris. Other than that, of course, you would think that Mr. Crush would quickly have his career ended by the outcome of this. Turns out that he went on to still have a long-time career with the railroad, and the railroad did settle the lawsuits that came out of the event. Just, they did go on to continue to have a promote special trains and such, though they never again did have a railroad sponsor an actual stage train wreck. But again, that did not prevent entrepreneurs like Joe Connolly to go on and stage such events himself in order to, again, to satisfy the people's curiosity and repressed desire to see something destroyed.
The event reminds me very much of a demolition derby where automobiles are used in the same way as entertainment, crashing into each other.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. They were the demolition derbies of the day, these stage train wrecks. And again, it was before the era of cars could be safely crashed together. And so again, like I say, Joe went on to a longtime career in staging these train wrecks in various cities around the country. And again, I haven't, even in the course of my research, I still haven't been able to find or locate all the cities where Joe had staged these collisions. So again, he did it out in Texas, in Illinois, back east, in various states there. They believe he may have staged a couple out in California as well, though, again, there was another stage train wrecker who actually did that for a number of years for the California State Fair. So Joe did have his imitators. But ultimately, as I said, Joe did this for about 30 years, and by 1933, Joe was about ready to retire, and I suppose he could see the handwriting on the wall as well, as far as people finding other forms of entertainment by then, which of course would be car demolition derbies or airplane shows with all their spectacular air feats. Joe, when he decided to retire, decided to stage one last train wreck. And that, again, was where he had started his career, and that was, again, at the Des Moines State Fair. And that being the midst of the Great Depression, State Fair folks were, again, looking for something to attract people to the fairgrounds, and, of course, they still thought, well, why not one more time stage a collision, and that was done during the fair. And it was done rather, again, Joe by then had pretty much perfected his craft, and people were saying that he did it rather spectacularly for the last time. By then, he was including railroad passenger cars coupled behind the locomotives, and once the locomotives impacted, he had also arranged for there to be canisters of gasoline in the railroad cars attached to the train, to the two locomotives. And upon impact, these canisters of gasoline would explode, and the cars would catch on fire. So not only would you have the impact of the locomotives, you'd have combustion of the railroad cars attached to the trains. So Again, people saw the spectacle, and the media were all were there in force. And again, there were movies made of the collision. And again, if you go on the internet, I think probably you could find some place where you could see that particular last collision by Joe staged or located somewhere on the internet for viewing. But a story that's told of Joe is that he was pretty much a low-key kind of guy, and the story is that one witness who was standing there close to Joe looked at him right after the collision, and Joe's kind of deadpan about it, and he just said, "Well, that's that," and he turned and walked away, and that was the end of his 30-year career at train wrecking.
Jim Reisdorf, when can we expect another book hot off the press?
I've got two off the press right now that are fairly new. Again, that books that my own niche publishing concern has put out. And I do have a couple of other books that I am distributing for other authors. And again, so right now, I guess, as of this interview in just before Thanksgiving 2020, I do have four new books out right again on website southplattpress.com. Again, we have those available, and again, there are others that are in the mill yet, and I anticipate having still another one or two books out in the first part of 2021.
Jim, you've kept us remarkably on the track.
Well, I'd hope so, that's where trains belong, of course, on the track. And would hope that such things as train wrecks, for the most part, are relegated to our past history. And again, that such terminology as, it's a train wreck is limited to our symbolism now, rather than actually being something physical that we experience in our lifetime.
I'm very grateful for the time and the courtesy you've shared with me and the listeners.
I do appreciate your being interested enough to include me in your podcast series here.